Cubberty on 2FM with Super Value Travel Insurance. Holidaying at home or abroad? Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance at supervalue.ie.
Now we're live on air now, Margaret, so just hold any nasty thoughts or words. Not that I'd say you have any at all. Margaret Nagel, good morning.
Good morning.
I like you already. I saw you, you came through the door with your fiery red hair, two copies of a book that we will talk about later, but more importantly with a great story. Welcome to Ireland, and I hope you're having a good time so far.
Oh, I'm having a great time. Thank you.
What part of the States are you from?
Right now I live in Los Angeles, but I've lived all over the United States.
Okay.
So.
What an unusual name, because it has a Nagel. There are Nagels around Ireland. I mean,
oh sure, Nano Nagel. Yes,
which of course was Mork and Mindy.
Yeah. No, Sir Richard Thomas Nagel was my great 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 grandfather long ago, and the Nagels we came over in the famine and went to the Midwest. All my McQuillans, Dempseys, Delaneys all went to Iowa, Illinois, came through Boston and Rhode Island, and have had a great life here in the United States. But this is also very much a part, you know, the idea of Ireland and what that brought to us.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
That's, you know, our origin.
And we're related?
And we are related through King John. On my mom's side, it's so funny. My mother would never tell us who we were related to or look at the genealogy, and she passed away this year. And I started digging through all of it, and turns out Strongbow, King John, Henry the First, Henry the Second, they're all grandparents.
Get away.
So it's pretty crazy.
So King John, when we did the Who Do You Think You Are program, it brought us to the College of Heraldry in London, and they kept unfolding these going, and that's related to him, to her, to him, to her, to him, and then all it went all the way Edward the Third and then back to King John, right?
So you
the
get
Magna Carta.
The Magna Carta. And I was like going, and then William the Conqueror, I'm a grandchild of William the Conqueror, but then of course like a quarter of anyone with English blood is from that William the Conqueror. He really got around.
He got around.
He was active.
He was a lover of the ladies.
He sure was.
But we wouldn't be here without him.
We wouldn't be here. So
without his
peccadillos. That's right. So here we are today.
Here's to the great philanderers of our time.
So,
okay, you have been involved in some great programs down through the years, including obviously Boardwalk Empire is the one that will strike a tone for a lot.
Right.
Of mm-hmm. You were a writer on Boardwalk Empire.
Yes, and there's a character named Margaret on it who seems to have my name. I don't know how that happened.
Did you write that character's name?
No, it was actually Terrence Winter created the show and created those characters, but he and I were good friends, and he's a real mentor to me as a writer. And when he invited me on the show, he was just starting. He said, I've got a character that I think you can write very well. And so because I was brought on right at the beginning, before we ever shot anything, we planned out that first, the entire first season of Boardwalk were three writers with Terrence, and we sat in a room for a very, very long time
and thrashed it all out.
Yeah.
How did you work on the authenticity? It's a beautiful piece to look at. I mean, it's delicious to watch. So how did you work on the authenticity of the language was what something you'd have to do?
We worked on the language, we worked on the history, we worked on the politics, the social. We were versed. I took a crash course in the birth of the mob, but also in the social and emotional politics of the time. And so we used every last detail. Everything tells a story.
Yeah.
So if you find out that women were bootleggers by putting flat bottles in their stockings and using their garters, well, that's really important to know what a garter is. And you know, so we had someone in the room who was an expert. His name was Ed McGinty. And he was there every single second, constantly looking things up, fact-checking. Mm. And then we were given a library of books that we needed to read before we even started on
tape. Research.
Yeah, it was really intense. So before day one, before we sat down in a chair and met each other, the group of writers, and we sat 10 weeks in a room with no interruption and started the beginning of the series and figured out what the last day of the series would be, and then took year one and broke year one sort of like it was a movie, like a 10-hour movie with an act one, an act two, and an act three.
Yeah.
And we, you know, the Detroit mob, the Philadelphia mob, you know, you've got an Irish mob, you've got an Italian mob, you've got a Jewish mob, you've got And it's all out of need.
Yes.
And it's all out of trying to get a piece of that American dream that's been denied to you.
Well, two things strike me. One is that you got a library of books. You weren't on the internet surfing because there's so much crap.
There's
on the
so
internet.
Much misinformation
and
on the
rubbish,
internet.
Yeah.
Everyone, there's so much.
Read
Wikipedia
a book.
Is so full of falsehoods,
it
and
is,
anybody
yeah.
can write things up there. I mean, I cannot begin to tell you.
I'm high-fiving you from here because
I mean,
so
I'm working
right.
on this HBO project about Joseph P. Kennedy, who was not a bootlegger. Yeah. He was not a bootlegger, but
everywhere it says it's
the first thing
like
anyone says to you
yeah.
about him.
Yeah.
And but that's all. So it's very frustrating. So
books are written by people who took the time to research it, become an expert in their field, and become an author.
And their notes were checked and double checked by editors.
Love this woman.
So it's and you can't just even like with the discussion of the genealogy, you can't take that off of line. Yeah. You've got to go to the libraries, to the experts, and work with them over an extended period of time.
Thank you.
So Boardwalk, even though Boardwalk did do some episodes with Joseph P. Kennedy, they made him a bootlegger, and then they said he wasn't really a bootlegger.
Okay,
there's like a
okay.
disclaimer on the episode. But
you
they,
got your hands on that
But
script.
I wasn't in the room at that time, but, you know.
But it all the roads, as we're talking, there's so many places we could go here, but one of them is, because you mentioned it twice, essentially, which is so far, which is about getting a piece of the American dream.
Right.
And you know, our story, I was talking only at the beginning of the week as a country. I was trying to contextualize the horror of those poor people on the boat.
I know.
The 900, 800 people. Imagine that. The boat listed as they ran over to one side to see what they thought was liberation. Desperately sad. But it had an echo of the Irish coffin ships going to, you know, Canada and, as you know, Boston and so on. And this all brings us down to your new movie, The Good Lie, which is about the road to a piece of the American dream.
That's right. And it's
all these stories connect.
It will. They say that as a writer, you're working out one story inside of yourself. That, and I think that what I'm always working out is what is the value of a human life, wherever it exists. Be it it's someone trying to find that piece of the dream and through the mob who has a huge backstory, or if it's a child trying to walk out of South Sudan thousands of miles through the sub-Saharan desert to have a taste of freedom and to be able to have an education and have a life beyond that. And so when you see, you know, the Irish, the ships, particularly the ships to Canada, which were really bad.
Yeah, the coffin ships.
Those were truly the coffin ships. And then what happened the other day, it was so interesting. The story was facing me on the front page of the New York Times as I flew Aer Lingus from Boston, because that's where I'd been to Dublin, and I just couldn't bear to look at the story. I couldn't bear it because I know the story.
Yes.
I know the story so well, and I'm going, why is this happening again?
Yeah.
Why are people still being indebted to people to put... First of all, they're indebted to whoever was able to get them on that boat, the slave trader, but then they're going to be, if they were to reach shore, they would be indebted to that person for possibly years of their life. There's an underbelly to trafficking people that's even worse than the underbelly you think that you're already seeing.
Yeah.
And so here you have a country like Ireland that is so generous, that is so charitable. You know, we're doing a screening of The Good Lie with Concern, which
Great.
Is an incredible organization on the ground in the helping the very poorest people in the world who are in the most desperate situation. And I think that it's time to revisit this.
Yeah.
It's time to revisit all of it. We're in the 21st century, and this is still happening.
You have a hard sell. Your movie has been very well received by people. They're calling it a slow burner. The people are saying there's the word of mouth. It mightn't have blown everyone away at the box office, but that's because it's a hard sell. Sudan is not going to be an easy sell, even to our listeners this morning, for you to say, I've done a movie about these child gangs and you know and the camps in Sudan. People will be thinking, I don't really want to see that, to be honest with you. That's a bit not my thing. But Reese Witherspoon's in it. Okay, well, now I'm sort of a bit more interested.
And Corey Stoll from House of Cards, who's incredible. And what it is, it's a story of hope. It's very funny. We just played it at a film festival in New Hampshire, in Keene, New Hampshire. And we had 700 people laughing so hard. They laughed. They cried. They said, that's not what I expected this story to be. And I said, well, the Sudanese are hilarious. They're so funny. This is a story about survival. It's a story. It's not about redemption. It's these kids, by their wits, through ingenuity, through their faith, through their sense of family, they survive.
You follow four refugees who are in this war-torn Sudan, for want of a better. And they just want out.
And we start with them as children.
Right.
We start with them as children, and they're actually played by the children of real lost boys and girls. These child actors are incredible, and then you segue. They've been in the refugee camp 13 years, and you segue, and they're young adults.
You just threw that away, Margaret. 13 years.
Yes.
In a refugee camp. Think about that. Think of 13 days. In a refugee camp. 13 years is a lifetime.
13 years is a lifetime.
It's a sentence.
And the average person spends 17 years to 25 years in a refugee camp. And at the end of World War II, very quickly, there were 50 million displaced people in the world.
Yeah.
Right now, there are 52 million displaced in the world, looking for safe haven.
And these are people without a country or a state.
That's right.
To claim them or to... It's so tragic because I was saying this at the beginning of the time, we as a nation were those soldiers. And I don't mean militarily. We were those people. Children, those people in rags, hopeless people. We were those people who ended up in Ellis Island, Gros Seal, or wherever it might have been.
Absolutely. And so the story of the Lost Boys is the story of us. And what's been so interesting is we have what's an A+ cinema score. And a cinema score is...
Yeah.
There were only 37 films in the last 40 years to have A+ cinema scores. And they're like The Godfather and Shawshank Redemption and The King's Speech. Mm. And this year, it was a big year for the cinema score. Three films got it: American Sniper, Selma, and The Good Lie.
Right.
But nevertheless, even with that, so people leave the theater and they love the film. They don't just like the film. They love the film. To get an A+ means, you know, there were no Bs to bring down the average.
Yes.
People love the film. They're passionate about the film. They tell their friends about the film. So and it's interesting because men love the film.
So you're selling it so well. I can't wait to see it.
And men love the film. It's been interesting, you know, because...
Why is it that men love the film?
Because... I think that every man in his life is on a journey to save his family. There's something bred in the DNA of every man. And in women, it's a little bit different, but I think that to go from boy to man, and because part of what you see is how they go from boys to men and how they become the men their fathers would have wanted, even though they grew up without their fathers, and finding that... making a new life for themselves, setting out on their own path. Every man needs to go and break new ground and find his life. That's a huge part of...
So they like that element of the story. Within the States, you find there are Sudanese communities of people who were in camps. Like the Irish would have had their neighborhoods.
Yes, we had a resettlement program in the early 90s, late 80s, where they brought over 3,600 lost boys from the refugee camp where there were 10 to 20,000, I guess, 20,000 lost boys in the refugee camp. They got 3,600 over, and they were resettled in groups: Fargo, Atlanta, Dallas, and San Diego, Kansas City. And then what happened was 9/11 happened, and the entire program was shut down, and they were all left in the refugee camp. And so because Osama bin Laden had trained terrorists in northern Sudan.
And there you are.
And Southern Sudan is all based on faith. That's the other thing, is the Lost Boys are Catholic. They're very religious. They're very devoted. Catholic. They believe that their faith is why they survived. You know, if you ask a Lost Boy, how can you believe in religion? Religion, this was a religious war. This genocide, this ongoing war in Sudan right now, it's the longest ongoing civil war in modern times. And it's gone on back and forth for 60 years. Now it's isolated in South Sudan, but... The last genocide that displaced 2 million people was a religious war, and it was the Islamic fundamentalists taking out the Christians. And they, you know, Lost Boys walked with their Bibles across the desert. That's the one thing they wouldn't give up, would be their Bibles.
Was that a colonial hangover, the mm-hmm. Catholic thing?
Yeah, okay, so it was a colonial hangover, but it was interesting. They never lost their, they grew up in these villages, very tight, very, their traditions of their family and their culture very much intact. Mm-hmm. And they had their religious faith, but they're also animists, which they believe that the grass and trees and anything that grows in nature has feeling.
Really?
And that you have to respect it. So they sort of took the best of Christianity and combined it with their own animist.
That's very caring.
Oh, it's very caring. They're extraordinary people. They're very funny. They're very gifted linguists.
Right.
They grew up speaking the King's English. They speak various tribal derivations. They understand Islamic derivations. They're they're very gifted linguists, very funny, charming people.
Okay, so but I'll tell you, you sell it well in the terms of a story. I'm dying to see it. Can I ask you a couple of quick things? You acted in My So-Called Life.
Yes.
And somebody gently took you aside one day and said, this isn't your game.
What happened was, it was the creator.
Very honest person,
yeah,
said to you.
Winnie Holtzman said to me, you know, you're fine as an actress. You'll do okay, but I have bad news for you. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm being fired. And she said, you're a writer. You're right. A storyteller.
How did she spot that? From your chat?
Just from talking, yeah, how right. I would talk about character and plot. And she said, you're a writer. You're a closeted writer and you need to go write something. And so I then set off and I wrote a script called Warm Springs.
So I'll jump in just to let people know that Warm Springs starred Kenneth Branagh and Cynthia Nixon, who people know from Sex and City. Kenneth Branagh, one of my favorite actors and directors, of course. And that was nominated for 16 Emmys and won 5.
Yeah.
How's that working out for you?
That was pretty good. That was my first script. And that was...
She was right.
She was right. And she was very thrilled when I went to the Emmy Awards, and the Writers Guild gave me their award for best screenplay, and it was my first script. But I'd read so many scripts as an actress, and when you're an actress, you're always inhabiting the writer's world.
Yeah.
So in a strange way, when you are trained to be an actor, you are being trained to be a writer.
Yeah.
One of my mentors is John Logan, who's been over here doing Penny Dreadful.
Yeah.
And John also said to me early on, as well as Winnie, you know, you're a writer. You tell the best stories. When are you going to write some down? So he was also nagging at me consistently for a long time.
With success. Okay. I'll drive them mad because I'm such a Kennedy head. But tell us about your Kennedy project as well. This is just a buy that I didn't know this.
I know, it's
today,
so crazy. So, and I didn't realize I was meeting you. I'm holding your book on the plane coming over, and just, it's a phenomenal book. I'm going to plug your book, JFK in Ireland.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
4 Days That Changed a President. This is, it is so filled. It puts you right there. You feel like you are how to encompass what that visit meant to JFK. It was the happiest 4 days of his life before he died.
Right.
But the happiest 4 days ever in his entire life, because his life and the four generations of Kennedys, his great-grandfather who came over on one of those coffin ships, to his life there, it all came full circle. It was almost complete. And Jacqueline Kennedy even said, supposedly off the record, and I'll tell you about this when we're off the radio, that, you know, without those 4 days, she wouldn't have felt, you know, it was terrible that he died, but those 4 days made his life.
Well, that's incredible. And the one story I love about with the Kennedy story was that the relative who left was called Patrick. And when Patrick got over there, and they all married up, the Kennedys, they all married up in class-wise. And the name Patrick started to get
rooted
out because they were Paddies and mixed. They didn't want to be very Irish. So by the time it came to JFK's dad, who wasn't a bootlegger, Joseph P., it stopped being Paddy Joe, Patrick Joe, so it became Joseph Patrick.
Right.
By the time they had kids, none of JFK's family were called Patrick, not one.
No.
They were called Robert and Edward and John.
Mm-hmm.
All very, we're anglicizing our way toward. He has two kids, Caroline and John. Comes to Ireland. Wife didn't come because she was pregnant. He gets home. Wife has baby. What do they call it?
Patrick.
And he died. Aww. He died. Yeah. And the circle was complete.
Well, isn't it amazing, though, that he also died on the same day that his great-grandfather died.
Yeah. I mean,
from overwork as a cooper. I mean, it's just amazing.
So you're doing a documentary?
No, it's a mini series, and I've been hired to write it for HBO, and Maria Shriver is one of the producers, and we're doing The Patriarch, which is the David Nassau book that's a big, big book all about Joseph P. Kennedy, and David O. Russell is also working on it. And we're doing 4 hours, and we're really going to
Go for it.
And we're really using Ireland as the place where it starts and the place where it ends. And to take, because I don't think you can understand Joseph P. Kennedy and all the choices he made if you don't understand the two generations that came before him and what it meant to be Irish and understand why putting JFK in the White House and what all of that meant. And if you do that, it takes the Kennedys we need in a 21st century to be reminded and to understand how powerful that was.
I'm going to play about 5 records in a row so we can talk off air because it will just bore them to death. path, but I'm loving everything you're saying, and we can have a chat about different things aside from that. So we're all going to have to go and see this film because it's so
The
Good Lie, which is going to be opening in Ireland. We'll all watch the miniseries
Friday night. It opens in Ireland. We're really
will
thrilled.
You be there?
Yes, and Thursday night we're having a sort of a gala opening with Concern.
Great.
To celebrate the incredible work that they're doing.
You're adapting the Danish show Legacy for American TV.
Yes, I am. I just signed on to that too.
Time to do everything.
Well, I like to write two things at once, and I've actually been just promoting the film with UNICEF and helping to raise money for the Good Lie Fund. We have a Good Lie Fund, and it's you see it at the end of the film, and if everybody gives, you know, $5 to our Good Lie Fund, UNICEF is managing that. Okay. And we've been able to give over $500,000 in humanitarian aid to Sudan just in the last few months, and we just keep making more money with the fund, and we're handing it over to Lost Boys, many of whom in the United States have started their own charities and on the ground humanitarian aid in South Sudan.
Now, so this is not a movie, it's a phenomenon.
Well, we're all here to help each other. That's what we've got to do.
Margaret, it's been a distinct pleasure. Thank you so much for coming to see us this morning.
Great to meet you.
We'll keep this chat going on. I'll just hit
Okay, cousin Ryan.
All right, cousin. Keep